Blog Talk Radio. To the Heretics Hour on this fine May 5th, 2014. I am Carolyn Yeager. Tonight, I have Margaret Huffstickler on board with me, and we're going to talk about women, something we know about, and in particular, women in nationalism, and some other related topics. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, Carolyn. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you are here. Makes me feel better. You're always a nice friend to have along. So, and we've got some interesting things for the listeners tonight. And you've been moving. I don't know that you want to talk about that at all, but so it's been a little hectic for you, I imagine.
Mm-hmm, yeah, a little.
Okay, well, there's two news items that came up today that I'd like to mention in the beginning here. The big one is that Vladimir Putin, president of Russia, today signed the bill, which was passed in the lower house of the Russian parliament, called the Duma, just 1 month ago. The author of the bill at that time said she hoped it would be signed into law by May 9th for the celebration of the Allied victory over Germany. And guess what? It was. I'm quite convinced. I mentioned this at that time. I mentioned this on my April 12th Saturday show. And I predicted at that time that it would be passed because it was introduced by a member of Putin's party, who was a member of the parliament there. And so therefore I figured for sure he was behind it. And it passed pretty easily in the lower house, and then I didn't hear more about it until today. And I want to thank Bill Fink for alerting me, sending me a link to what he had put up on his Mein Kampf site, but he had a translation, a Google translation from an article in the Ukrainian news outlet, and because I couldn't read it myself, I just kind of hoped it was right, and I kept looking for things, but I had to later, about a half hour, I managed to Google it. I was looking in the wrong place, I guess. And I did come up with it, and then I put it on my own site. I think it's terrible. Margaret, what do you think? I mean, it's big news. It's kind of a big mark of something, but it's not good, is it?
Yeah, I'm not too surprised. You know, I didn't expect Putin to be revisionist or white nationalist or anything. I don't know if you've noticed that in Solzhenitsyn's 200 Years Together. He bashes the Germans. He totally seemed to believe in the Holocaust. So it's interesting. It seems to be very hard for a lot of Russians to grasp the truth of it or to want to go there.
Yeah, yeah, they don't want to go there. So this didn't take long for it to get through the approval system.
No.
And Putin signed it today, supposedly, on the 5th. And, of course, on the 9th is the big Allied celebration going to take place. And they're going to be especially big one in Moscow, I read, and they're already rehearsing and they've got streets blocked off and so on for this big day. So God knows what's coming up in the way of speeches and so on. And so I want to read what I put on my site this morning, and there's been more published about it since, I'm sure. I did read something else, but this is good enough. It says that President Vladimir Putin has signed a law banning the rehabilitation of Nazism, the Kremlin press service said on Monday. The law, which introduces criminal punishment of up to 5 years in jail, that's just like in Europe, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just like Germany's, for the denial of facts set out in the post-war Nuremberg trials. Gee whiz, that's the official truth there, the Nuremberg trial. And for the dissemination of false information on the actions of the Soviet Union during the war. It was adopted earlier by Parliament, it says. Here's a little bit more of it. Publicly desecrating symbols of Russian military glory or spreading false information, disrespecting public holidays related to the country's defense, will be punishable by a fine of up to 300,000 rubles, which is $8,400, or community service for up to a year. That's for that second one.
Mm.
But for the denial of facts as set out by Nuremberg trials, that's 5 years if you're found guilty of it. The way I see it, Putin's Russia is joining Merkel's Germany and the other Austria and those others that felt absolutely compelled to pass strict laws against any of it. And so the idea that there is more freedom in Russia in the last 10 years or so, or 15, and there was sort of, I think, I don't know, but, you know, along certain lines. But that's gone by the wayside now.
Yeah, there was. Of course, you know, it goes back and forth. Spain had refused to have a law against Holocaust denial for, you know, a few years, like about 3 years maybe. Pedro Varela got, he still got thrown in jail anyway, in prison for hate. But they didn't have an actual, they said specifically, we do not have a Holocaust denial law. And then the conservatives came in and they put in a Holocaust denial law. So I guess it's expediency. I haven't,
And it was the conservatives, that did it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Like the people who would be the inheritors of the Franco.
I guess so.
Yeah. They shouldn't have been doing that. They shouldn't be doing that.
No. Franco is supposed to be a big ally of the fascists and everything, but I don't think so exactly. But the thing is, I don't hold it against Putin exactly. I don't like it, but I don't, it was already obvious he wasn't a white nationalist I'm sorry, did I just played with my cord.
Yeah, don't do it.
I won't do it.
Okay.
So he already had taken actions against white nationalists and stuff, and it seems to me he's a good leader for his people as it goes, and he tries to work for them, and I think maybe it's a wise move for him to take considering the situation the country is in, with all the war propaganda and stuff going on, and he's been standing up for Syria and Iran, which I think is good, and being compared to Hitler and all that. And, look at Gaddafi, what happened to him, and Saddam Hussein. Maybe he's saying, okay, I'll pass this Holocaust law. I think it will be, I'll be more down on him. I mean, I really don't like it, but I'm not in his shoes. But if he actually starts throwing in people in jail through this law, then I'll,
well, you really think that this is just a political front and he's not going to actually enforce it?
I think there's a chance that...
I don't think there's a chance of that. I think there's so many people saying things like this. And I just have to say, I think it's quite naive. And he's never behaved like that. And now what's happened is he's joined with the European Union. He's supposed to be standing against, people think, he's standing against the European Union, and he's a good bulwark against what they're doing. Well, he's just joined them in this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do think that it's good what he's doing in terms of opposing them on the Ukraine, you know, I mean, which is...
Well, that's why you think what you do, because I don't know... well, yeah, the Ukraine thing is a total mess.
And I think he stands up for his people. He's not a white nationalist, and he's not standing up for the German people. And it's not very, you know, he should certainly stand up for his people's freedom of speech, and I don't like that at all. But I do think probably, and I'm not saying at all that he won't enforce it, you know, I'll be happier if he doesn't. But I think he's a decent guy in terms of being a leader for his people, and that he's doing what he thinks is best to do. I sort of find it hard to believe that he actually thinks the Holocaust happened. I think he's too smart for that, so I think it's a very, not...
Well, then he's not standing up for truth at all.
No,
you know, I'm a person who stands on, I think, you know, I want the truth.
Yeah.
And the Nuremberg trials, it's obvious that the Nuremberg trials were a total charade of justice and a bunch of lies. And like you said, if he's paid any attention to it, which maybe he has not.
Yeah, it's also possible
know that. And so he's going along with you know, historical lies of a gigantic nature. So I can't be for that for any reason.
Well, I guess it's possible that he doesn't know it, that he actually has chosen not to look at it because he doesn't want to know.
Yeah.
But I don't like it. I don't like it at all. But on the other hand, I'm saying I'm not as down on him as you are, because I think that he's doing a pretty good job for his people, and that's good, you know. So, but I don't like what he's doing.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, now there, you know, while I was looking at that article, I saw another one that is also from today, and the Russian government published an 80-page report today detailing widespread and gross human rights violations in Ukraine over the past 6 months, for which it blamed the new government and its Western allies. Now, the heading of this says, Russian Foreign Ministry report claims extremists from ultra-nationalist and neo-Nazi forces had active support from U.S. in staging Kiev coup in February. And then it goes on to say that the report was published online in English. Isn't that nice? It's the latest salvo in an information war in which Russia says its adversaries are Ukrainian fascists who took power in a coup against the Kremlin-backed elected President Viktor Yanukovych. Now, this is from Ynet News. That's Israeli. Doesn't give a source. Says the report does not give a source for many of the incidents and allegations it describes, ranges from an account of the demolition of a statue of Lenin. See, they can't stand that. Tearing down the statue of Lenin, to the storming of public buildings, beatings of Jews, that was one of the complaints, and the killings of 77 people in Kiev in the days before Yanukovych fled to Russia. And, you know, people didn't like Yanukovych, except the Russian-speaking people.
Well, actually, a lot of people must have liked him because he was voted in democratically. So, you know, that was pretty hyped up how many people didn't like him.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there you go. All of this is happening, and I guess I don't like being on the side of the Western governments, but I am on the side of the West. So,
I think I'll say another thing about Putin, which I forgot to say, which is I think there's a huge amount of anti-Nazi fervor in Russia in general, because they still got that, you know, that's what brought them together, the Great War and crap, and Great Patriotic War. And anyway, so I think that that's not only looking at the West and the Jews and what they can do, but about looking at his own people. And anyway, I'm not going to even say that he should necessarily be standing up for the truth if he thinks he's going to get kicked out of office for it and not be able to do anything, because that's where, and so I can't really say. I don't like it, but I don't know where he's coming from, and I won't say one way or another.
Okay, there's another story here that I saw at this time, and it's Russia plans casino boom in Crimea. This is from yesterday. No, this is from the 21st of April. I knew this wasn't new, but I hadn't seen it. Well, there's a whole story here I could read, but I did read it, but I don't have it here. I did read it this morning, and he was saying like this, well, no reason we can't get back to normal or something like that, you know, after he had taken over Crimea. Now we can just go right on and develop things economically, and he's got these plans to develop Crimea, and he's going to increase the places where you can have casinos there. Well, you know, Hitler saw Crimea as Europe's playground or vacation land and place for Germans to go take vacations and so on, as he was seeing it as being part of his little empire there. And now it seems like Putin is doing the same thing. You know, Putin copies Hitler an awful lot, while at the same time he bashes him. I wouldn't say that's saying something good about him, because everybody does that. I mean, all the people who utilize the good ideas that Hitler came up with and his party and his government came up with are being used, but nobody will give him any credit for it. I really hate that. I hate it when I'm not given credit for what I've done, and I hate it when other people are not given credit.
Yeah, well, most of the good things in the European Union are from Hitler.
That's right. Yeah. So my comment there is that Putin wants Crimea to be Europe's playground, just like Hitler did.
Interesting. So,
yeah, interesting. You got to look, you know, I won't bother saying because I've already said it, but, you know, just that there's an overwhelming need, it seems, in people to see something good, have some hero somewhere, and they're trying real hard to make Putin be that person, and I'm very skeptical about that. But then you sent me a story about and someone else has sent it to me, John Clem sent it to me this morning, but I saw it, but I didn't have time to read it, but I did read it now, and that's one from the Rialto Unified School District. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, that's pretty interesting, isn't it? It's pretty brave of somebody to actually do that. Well, I don't have it in front of me.
So maybe
you should tell about it.
I do. It's just that this school district in California is coming under fire, but only under fire from guess who? The Anti-Defamation League, and probably other similar organizations will join in, for having this assignment given to eighth grade students. A writing research project asking them to research the Holocaust and argue whether or not they believe it was real or fictional. Now, it didn't seem in this story yet that there is a great big uproar, but someone, Matthew Friedman from the Anti-Defamation League, was quoted, naturally that's the only people they quote, as saying, it's not a debate, you know. Historians all agree the Holocaust is historical fact. So then he went on to say, he's the only person they quoted here, to have students try and determine whether or not it happened, they're going to go online and they're going to Google the Holocaust and come across sites that look very slick and very persuasive, but are really bad history and propaganda for anti-Semites. And that's not what we want them to be doing.
That's right. That's not what the ADL wants them to be doing, you can be sure. But, right. You know, that reminds me of what some people have said about revisionists. They're really slick. They use references to real documents and evidence or something like
right,
that.
Right.
Yeah, very slick, you know. They actually do real history.
I don't think they're going to get away with this. It sounds good now, but somebody at the Unified School District released this statement.
Yeah.
Our interim superintendent will be talking with our Educational Services Department to assure that any references to the Holocaust not occurring, of that saying the Holocaust didn't occur, will be stricken on any current or future argumentative research assignments. Well, So I guess it's already being crossed out.
But I guess the
go ahead.
The real story here is somebody was very subversive. Somebody got this.
I don't know. Yeah, how did somebody think they could get away with this?
Maybe they didn't. Maybe they just figured they put it out there, and you know, somebody's going to Google it for just
reading
this article.
Well, they make it sound like it was the Educational Services Department, a whole department.
Yeah,
there might
well,
not be that many people in it, but a department came
yeah,
up
maybe,
with that.
Yeah, maybe somebody didn't have that much supervision. And, you know, once they put it in there and then a story like this comes up, how many people are going to Google it because they're not supposed to or because they happen to read about it?
Yeah, no, it's going nowhere.
Well, I don't think nowhere. I just think every time it gets out, it goes, you know, somebody looks it up. I just think it's good to do this for somebody to do this in the school department.
Well, it is. Somebody should, you know, follow up on it. Somebody in California. How about your friend John Friend? Tell him to.
Oh, yeah. He should contact the Rialto School.
Yeah.
District.
You know, and make a big thing out of it. I mean, try to, you know, try to keep it in the news for a while.
That might be good. Well, you know, I don't know. Do you know if anything ever happened with that girl who wrote the paper saying
no.
The Holocaust didn't happen, she got an A on it.
No.
I wonder if the teacher was fired who gave her an A.
Yeah, I don't know.
Look that up and see what happened.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, then naturally at the end, the spokesman says the district takes issues of intolerance very seriously. And so it's intolerant to ask these students to research it and give their opinion. They're supposed to learn how to do that. That's what research is. You don't have a preconceived idea, right? She's not saying all this. This is me. You don't start out, you know, with one idea. That's not research, is it?
In today's universities, that is research. You are not supposed to get opinions from unapproved sources or facts from unapproved sources.
And then she said the district made plans 3 months ago to have a group of students visit the Museum of Tolerance in June. You see, now this school district is going to have to take all their students to the Museum of Tolerance now to make up for what they've done.
They'll probably have to go to Auschwitz now.
Well, speaking of John Friend, let's move along.
Wait a minute. I want to say one more thing about this. That this subversive person seems to have been able to get another line in here. The school district says, so who is this person who managed to get this out and also managed to say this? Says the purpose of the assignment is to help the students develop critical thinking skills and debate whether the Holocaust was a, quote, propaganda tool that was used for political and monetary gain, unquote. Somebody actually managed to say that.
Yeah, I read that too, but I don't see it now. But anyway, I'm glad you...
That's pretty provocative.
It makes me think
the person who talked to them was the same person who put this assignment out.
Mm-hmm. Well, probably. So somebody's in there doing good things.
Yeah. So, interesting.
Ugh.
It's not a debate, says Matthew Friedman.
Right. It's not a debate. Everybody agrees. All historians agree. Okay.
Or else.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned John Friend, and you and I were talking, or I brought up this... A European Nights Project, which I talked about on that April 12th program. Boy, there was a lot in that program and started such a big war at the White Network. But someone who's a regular listener, Steve, wrote to me about, he says he was looking over that site and he was quite, what he saw, he was surprised at and he was really confused about it and he wished I would do a program on it, and I told him I didn't think I could do a program on it because I didn't understand it very well. It was such a hodgepodge, and I was talking to you, and you told me that John Friend had interviewed this Vallone guy, or do you pronounce it Vallone? V-A-L-L-O-N-E, Mark.
Yeah, Vallone.
Vallone, okay.
Yeah.
This Vallone...
You got in that double consonant, Vallone. I heard it.
Okay. And he did interviewed him on one of his programs, and I said, oh, I want to listen to that. Well, I did, and it was from 2013, like maybe September or something. So it was quite a while ago. And people should look that up from 2013 on John Friend's talk show page if they want to hear it. There were some problems with the communication and so on, and they were losing him, you know, because he's over in Europe, and they thought that was the reason. But it was, you know, you learn some things, and I learned that this fellow that is on there called Geo Wolf is the same person as the one called Giacomo, or he was calling him Giacomo.
Giacomo, that's how you pronounce it.
Oh, I figured he must have been told that. It sounded funny, though. Giacomo, Giacomo. He was saying, we're losing you. We're losing you. It's a Giacomo.
Yeah.
Okay, Giacomo Vallone is Geo Wolf.
You suspected before, right?
Well, I kind of did, but I didn't want to say so because I thought, well, they could be different, because I thought I knew who this Geo Wolf is, and so maybe but they're the same person. So it's one person behind this, and he's makes it look like he's got lots of associates and so on from different countries, and there's a lot of different things. There's too much variety, but there's a theme that he has, which I have to admit I find interesting, and I even kind of agree with it, which is that nationalism should be a nation based,
mm-hmm.
and not. He's very much against white nationalism because he calls it international. And I read quite a bit more on there. But I can say something about what interested me the most was his article on white nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that I'm a adherent or that I follow this or that I believe it or I think it's right. I'm just saying I think it has possibilities for being truthful. And
I think it's interesting to talk about, like, what are the alternatives for, you know.
Yeah, we should be able to talk about them, shouldn't we?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was talking about, political correctness.
Yeah, well, I heard program that caused all the ruckus, and you basically were asking questions. You were saying, I don't know about this. What does anybody else think?
Yeah.
I heard you say that, something like that. I'm thinking that to some extent this is a straw man. I may be wrong about it, but it seems to me he's like, we believe national borders, cultural, no, that's not what I wanted to quote. Anyway, he's saying that he thinks white nationalism is equivalent to internationalism and basically Marxism or very similar to globalism or Marxism. And I don't see that necessarily.
Well, it isn't necessarily. He's going, you know, he's taking it to the worst extreme.
Yeah, I think it's
a straw man. Yeah, it is in a way. I think what he's getting at, and he has a point there in seeing that calling the other internationalism, is that he doesn't see all white nations as the same,
mm-hmm.
and he doesn't want there to be crossovers. He doesn't want all white people to live wherever they want to live in white nations. Once the white nations, you know, were...
But I don't know. I'm not sure if that's what any white nationalists are saying.
Different white nationalists will say, they will say, they'll say, oh, well, we don't mean that. We just mean that, we should all be for one another, and we should support one another, and there's all different. You see, there is no one thing called white.
Yeah.
There's no one white. And that's one of the points I was always making. That what is white nationalism, and different people see it differently.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
because some people do think that all white people are the same, and it's great that we can have Romanian people marrying German people or Swedish people marrying Polish people, and we can just mix around like that. I just happen to believe that that's not the best way to think about it at all.
Yeah, well, I haven't heard people say that much.
Oh, I have.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't.
Oh, yeah. That's what's good in the United States because, you know, everybody's just married everybody else, and so it's all mixed.
Yeah. Of course, it just happens here automatically because most, I mean, you know, lots of the people don't even know what their background is. All they know is they're Americans. So
yeah, but, yeah, and even if they do, if the more that it is not one thing, the more likely they are not to care about what other, somebody else's is. I'm not speaking racially here. I'm speaking as far as white goes.
Yeah.
A lot of people think that's perfectly, not only all right, it's good. You know, it's good. And it's hard to say it's not good because it sounds very like you don't like some of the white people as much as other white people. But it's basically that I do think there are a lot of differences. And what this Vallone is saying is that I think a lot of it comes from the way he was brought up by his father and, you know, so on. But that he thinks that the various cultures in Europe need to be kept intact. And even he uses an example that I think he lives in northern Italy.
Mm-hmm. Now. He's American, right?
And he says, I don't want a Pole to come and say he's my neighbor where I live. And then later he said, well, it's okay if a certain number of I'll say this first, and I'll quote this. Certain number of them come if they're invited or they're welcome or there's work for them to do or something. But they have to accept our culture and follow our culture altogether, you know, and fit into our culture and not cause any trouble or anything or they're gone. Because this is his idea of how to keep European cultures. He's very traditional-minded. Intact, and this is what he wants. Now, a lot of people think, well, nothing's going to stay the same, and you're not going to keep all this the way it was, and it's going to change. And then in Europe, you know, they're pushing the idea that we're all Europeans, and David Duke has been pushing that idea for a long time.
Oh, yeah?
We're Europeans, and we should think of ourselves as Europeans. Even if we're in Europe and we have our own little countries there, we're still... we should be Europeans, and that's the European Union idea.
Well, there are different, very different forms of that, you know. I mean, and I think that's something that would be very interesting to talk about in terms of this European Knights project, because something that bothers me a little bit with this European Knights, well, various things. One thing is...
Yeah, me too.
One thing is, you know, his thing is, I think on that radio show, he had this thing about this picture he saw of some... I don't know if they're blacks or Native Americans sitting at a campfire with Canadians.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, all the same culture and everything, and that's great. And
well, he was saying that because of the problem of what about the United States?
Yeah, where it's
and,
all right.
And he said Canada was the same, and that he said there was no way to go back to what the European nations had, because the United States never had it to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And except when it was a British Anglo colony, and it was mostly British here, then it was pretty much, you could say, but then they let that go. And they didn't do that so happily either, but other people came, and, you know, these laws are passed to allow people to immigrate. And they think they need people. Big country like U.S. could handle a lot of people.
Well, really, so. they didn't think that until 1965. You know, they didn't think they needed anybody except various Europeans.
That's right. Well, I'm just saying that different Europeans came and it became a mixed European land.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not always so easy to integrate some European groups.
Exactly.
A lot of discrimination against them.
That's
the British... or what you might call the Anglo-Saxons or the Anglos or something, a lot of them didn't like any of these people. They didn't like Germans. They didn't like Catholics.
They didn't like
anybody. They certainly didn't like the Italians or the Irish, you know.
Yeah.
So, but eventually it all, you know, happens, and it becomes a melting pot. And so what he was saying, I thought that was shocking too, but when I listened
Yeah,
I realized he was trying to answer John's questions and saying that he thought that if different races that were already here, like, say, in the United States, behaved, had a sense of belonging, had a sense of being Americans, and some of them do, but a lot of them don't, then you could live with them. He said you didn't have to marry them and you didn't have to, you know, hang out with them, but you could live with them. And some of these people, black people and so on, you could live with.
These guys sitting around the campfire.
He's saying they were the white couple was together and doing their thing, and this other black couple was together and doing their thing. And
I see. I thought they were at a campfire.
But they weren't really together, he said.
I see. I don't understand that. But
yeah, right. Well, I mean, it's touchy. I mean, because what do you do? I've said this forever. What do you do about the United States? You can talk about what should be done in European nations, and it's easier to be a nationalist there than it is here, because it's a totally different situation here, and John brought that up. But I want to quote here something that is from what this Vallone said in his White Nationalism, which is actually titled Letter to White Nationalists, Neo-Nazis, KKK, and Other Morons. That's what the title of this article is. But that's where he's got all his ideas about this. And he says, it is our belief, his project group here, that the Slavonic lands of the East and once Aryan lands of Asia, which I think would mean India, basically, are no longer compatible with the West assuming we were ever compatible. So this is he's right here, at least. He makes the point that he thinks there's a difference between Slavs and Western Europeans.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's one of his points. I'm not saying it's right, but I'm saying that's one of his points. And then the other one that I have bolded here is that any prospect of mass immigration from these lands, these ones I just mentioned and immigrants from, he says they're no more compatible than immigrants from Africa. And so any prospect of mass immigration from these lands is to be avoided if we want to preserve our unique cultures and way of life. Now, he seems to think in Europe there that he doesn't want this big invasion, you might call it, I should call it an invasion, but move of Slavic people into Western Europe. And that's what's happening with the European Union.
It is happening?
Yeah.
So that's why he's talking about it.
Yeah, because, you know, the European Union has this thing you can't open travel if you're European.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I agree that should not be. I think every country should have their own boundaries and be able to enforce them. Of course, I'm totally anti-European Union. But I want to mention, you know, I mentioned a couple of weeks ago now, some other ideas of this which are somewhat opposed to this Vallone's position, in that they are for close cooperation among European countries and even a federation, but not the European Union, and not anything like the European Union that can invade the insides of the each country. And so I thought it would be interesting for you to maybe for a future program look at this Europäische Aktion, which is by Bernard Schaub. And I think maybe there may be more than one thing like this, but this is called European Action, and it has an English section, so you can read about it. And it's for the actual, one of the things it doesn't do is cut out Eastern Europe, but it's in favor of boundaries between each ethnic nation. Anyway, it's a whole different concept, but it does not, it's not in favor of travels of.
Yeah, I read it. I read some of it, and I agree. It sounded pretty good to me, better than a lot of other. It's not really would you call it white nationalist? I mean, it's not like the other some certain types of white nationalism.
It's European nationalism,
yes,
I would say.
Right.
Because it's, you know, I think, you know, they would cooperate with people, European stock people in other parts of the world, but there really is for Europe. And what they're saying, which I think is very, very important, is, you know, can we just as separate little countries defend ourselves? We know what happened to Germany when they tried to stand up against the big guys.
Yeah, but you know what? You know the big problem with that? Of course, maybe this is what you're going to say. But it's because none of the European nations stood by Germany.
Exactly.
They joined Germany's enemies.
Exactly.
So Germany was fighting everybody there.
Exactly. So what this is talking about is that Europe needs to, first of all, of course, kick out the European Union, and then federate and have a common defense and a common foreign policy, but everything else individual. And he's interested, I think, in these patrias carnales, which are ethnic states, rather than big states with a bunch of ethnic groups in them. And I don't know how that would work out. It's happening. Of course, it's happening. The Crimea is an example right now. And, of course, Catalonia is trying to do that, and Scotland's
trying.
Well,
what do you mean Crimea is a part of the Russian Federation now?
Yeah, they're majority Russian, and they voted for that in a referendum.
Right.
97%.
It is.
They're mostly Russian. They voted to join Russia. So it's self-determination for the people, basically. Of course, there are the Tatars there, but I don't know if they have any space in Crimea that's enough just Tatars to say, we want our own country in here. But basically, do you know anything about the convention in Charlottenburg where they talked about, they were designing, the SS had this map of Patrias Carnales, which was the various countries that would be of one ethnicity, basically?
No, but I've been in Charlottenburg. It was very nice.
Yeah, well, I don't know much about that either. Joaquin Bochaca wrote a book just a couple of years ago called Europa Alternativa a Chaos, Europe Alternative to Chaos. And his idea was very similar to the European Action idea, that everybody has to choose their own, you know, nation states and just to cling to their own and make their own states and then federate in a big big group to protect themselves. But, anyway, so that's an interesting, because I can't, well, the thing about this European Knights, I can't imagine you have the Western European countries, so who's he talking about? Scandinavia and Germany and France and Spain and Italy, because got to be Italy because he's there. And
all of that.
And
England, yeah.
And then all of them are separate. They're not federated, but the European Union is gone. And then what?
Well, he probably imagines there's cooperation, but I really don't know because, again, I think that he doesn't have anything really worked out real well unless he hasn't published it yet. You know, all kinds of things are still coming on that website. And it's one of those confusing websites. See, I was thinking today, you know, or yesterday, I don't know, but, you know, well, clearly he's not German, because I thought he might be because he was using the word wolf and so on, wolf. But he's very, very National Socialist and fascist. He's very loyal National Socialist, but he doesn't like neo-Nazis or
That's
any of that
right.
kind of thing.
And see, again, I think he's got a straw man there because he's like, white nationalism equals neo-Nazi equals skinheads equals Ku Klux Klan, and we're not going to go with that. So, okay, good. Now he's got himself a position, but, you know, he's lumped a lot of people under neo-Nazis and Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah, right. What you were asking, I was saying, his website. Yeah, he's not German because he's not organized.
Yeah.
He's very smart. I think he's very smart, and he writes a lot of stuff, and it's pretty good. But it's a disorganized thing. I mean, why doesn't he? He's like Rodney Martin. He gets this some software and builds his own weird kind of looking website. Why doesn't he just go to WordPress or something and get something where the organization is already there and you just follow along and can work with it that way? Because this is really hard to follow, and I can't see where he's that part of it I don't like. And a lot of the text is way too small, and it's all different, and it's just everything is goofy with it.
He's an Italian.
Yeah, there you go. He's an Italian. So there you go. This is part of what I really see, in that people are, European people are so different. And it's hard for someone, it can be hard for an organized German mind to put up with a disorganized, either maybe somewhat Italian. I don't want to say all Italians are disorganized. I'm sure they're not, or such. But now here's the thing I want to say before we get off of this, is that it's been accused that it's a Jewish site, and even this Steve said, well, I think this maybe is a Jewish mole here or front or something, you know, but I don't think so, I don't believe he is at all Jewish, and I don't think he's lying about it. I think he's sincerely anti-Jewish and Jew-wise. Apart from whatever other faults he might have. What is your opinion on that?
Yeah, I didn't see him as being Jewish. And one of the things I kind of liked in his program with John King that he said was that basically...
John Friend.
What did I say? Oh, yeah, I said
John
King. John Friend was that... since he realized that he couldn't get anywhere politically, duh... he's just using his site to expose the Jews, basically, and just put out the truth. And that seems like a good goal, to just keep getting the truth out.
That's what you said this Baloney said.
Yeah, he said that basically on John Friend.
Oh, yeah.
That he's just trying to put out a lot of news every day and just all the stuff about the truth about the Jews and what they're doing to our society.
Yeah, I think he's sincere, and so for that reason, you know, I kind of like him. And it looks like he's doing all this himself, trying to get people on board with him, but basically he's doing it himself. And so it's a lot of work, and so he's, you know, slowly adding things. He's got things listed there, but they're not actually there yet. Okay, go ahead.
I just was going to say, you said it bothered you, there are things from Veronica Clark on there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I haven't seen that much of hers. I had been bothered by other things I'd seen by her, but what is your story about her?
Well, he has an article there. I'd have to go over there, which I could do. Diversity, I don't know.
We don't have to do it if you don't want. We can.
Well, I want to tell people what it is. I think since we brought it up, because that's the thing that really bothers me. And it's on the, I believe it's on the home page. If I go there and open this page up, I think I'll see it. Because it's that thing she wrote about, how diversity is good or right.
Oh yeah, I remember she had some colored friends on her other site. So she definitely is multi-culti herself.
Well, and she's given her whole argument there, and he seems to think it's worth putting on his website. He may not agree with all of it. I'm not seeing exactly.
Yeah, I'm not seeing it now either. I'm on that phone bit.
But I know it's here. It's here. If people look, they'll come. They'll find it. They'll come across it. But you know where she's written this thing about how kind of the way he's saying it, that you can have these people in your country because there's no way to get them out anymore, and but you don't have to marry them. You don't have to live next door to them. Well, you know what? Well, I guess if you have your own government and you don't. you know, you pass these kind of laws, you could do it that way, mm-hmm. if they would allow it. If they're, if these non-white people are you know, are agreeable to having white government, but at the, you know, if they're not going to vote or something, that would be nice. But there's a lot of people who are really committed to having white societies and not multiracial societies, and I'm actually one of them. I mean, I'd like that. Uh-huh. I realize that in this country, in my country, the United States, it probably can't happen, but it could be better than it is now, and you could kind of live with people if you get a lot of them out of here. You could keep some mm-hmm. of them, and you could live with it. You could, you know, we used to live with it. It was not so bad.
Yeah, you know, before you had such propaganda, such anti-white propaganda, and
yeah. So, but I would say they should try to get all of that out of Europe. I don't like it there.
I think so. They're the indigenous people there. There's just no question about it. They are the Aborigines in Europe, and for them to be genocided by importing people who outbreed them and actually kill them and et cetera, is it's genocide and it should not be allowed. And hopefully the tide will gradually turn, because it does seem to be turning slowly.
Uh-huh. Well, you're more optimistic.
I don't know if it'll turn all the way, but I mean, I think we do see more people getting the picture.
Oh, I think so too. I agree with that. And let's hope it speeds up, you know. It just mm-hmm. starts to what do you call it? Snowballing or something.
Yeah, that's the nature of momentum, you know.
Yeah, momentum. Right. Well, we've got 8 minutes left before the first hour is up, and we have some clips here that you supplied, Margaret, of the song Lily Marlene. We have three versions of it, and we're going to use that for our break music, but we're not going to play them all at the same time. So you're going to tell me when they should be played, and so you can start talking now about this song and why you wanted to discuss it tonight and all that you know about it and so on. And then we don't have to play the clips in any particular time, but you might have an order that you want to play them in, so you just let me know. I've got them all here.
Okay. I mean, do you want to start on this subject now then?
Yes, I think we better.
Okay. Well, maybe first of all we could play the 1939 version with Lala Anderson, which is the one that became the absolute most popular song in World War II on all sides and was translated into 50 languages. And it was a German song, and my thesis for whatever I'm going to say about it is basically it's not an accident. It wasn't just a quirk at all. It's a really wonderful song, and it's a very, very German song. And people really appreciated it, and they, even the authorities not wanting people to appreciate it wasn't enough, because it just got to people. So maybe we could start out with the Lala Anderson.
Okay, you don't want to say any more about it. You
okay.
just want to play it, and then you want to talk about it after that.
Yeah, I think maybe play the.
Okay,
play
all right, and I can play it more than once. So okay, I'm going to play this one now.
Der Kaserne vor dem großen Tor stand eine Laterne und steht sie noch davor. So wollen wir uns da wiedersehen. Bei der Laterne wollen wir stehen, wie einst Lili Marlene, wie einst Lili Marlene. Unsere beiden Schatten sahen wie einer aus, dass wir so lieb uns hatten, das sah man gleich daraus. Und alle Leute sollen es sehen, wenn wir bei der Laterne stehen, wie einst Lili Marlin, wie einst Lili Marlin.
Wie einst Lili Marlin.
Schon rief der Posten, die Bliesen zapfen Streich. Es kann 3 Tage kosten, Kamerad, ich komm ja gleich. Da sagten wir auf Wiedersehen, wie gerne würde ich mit dir gehen. Mit dir, Lili Marleen, mit dir, Lili Marleen. Deine Schritte kennt sie, deinen schönen Gang. Alle Abend brennt sie, doch mich vergaß sie lang. Und sollte mir ein Leid geschehen, wer wird bei der Laterne stehen? Mit dir, Lili Marleen, mit dir, Lili Marleen. Aus dem stillen Raume, aus der Erde Grund, gibt mich wie im Traume dein verliebter Mund. Wenn sich die späten Nebel drehen, werd ich bei der Laterne stehen, wie einst Lili Marleen, wie einst Lili Marleen.
Okay, that's the song.
Okay. So that's the song that it was sung by Lala Anderson, who is a Swedish, I don't know. This, I just was reading this. This says a Swedish. No, she was German.
Her real name. German, yeah.
Yeah, this, I just was looking at this and I said Swedish because it says this. But anyway, she had sung another version before, which we'll play a little bit later. And then, anyway, so I'm going to say why this is such a great song. First of all, it's the melody, right? And the combination of the melody and the rhythm that really gets in your ear, because
we keep hearing you moving your
headset
around, and we did during the music too.
Oh yeah? Oh no.
Yeah.
I forgot about it. Okay. I'm going to behave myself.
Okay.
Okay. So, I'll just tell a little bit of the history first. This was written by Hans. The poem was written by Hans Leip, because I was looking at this version by John Steinbeck writing about, which I want to tell people about, because this is an example of nasty propaganda about it, and
okay.
Almost nothing in it was true. Okay, so Hans Leip wrote the poem, actually, during the First World War, and it was called The Song of a Young Sentry. And he didn't even really finish it then. He finished it later in the 30s, and it was then set to music by, first by somebody else, and then by Norbert Schulz, who was a well-known composer of operas and popular songs. And that's the version that became known. It wasn't successful at first. And
when was this? Did you say I missed it?
It was written, she recorded it in 1939.
Yeah, I know that. When did he write it? Right then?
He wrote the...
It's a World War One poem.
Yeah, the poem was written in World War One,
right.
But it wasn't set to music until the 1930s, and in 1938, I think, is when Norbert Schulz said it, and in 1939, Lala Anderson recorded it, and she had already sung another version of it, but it wasn't particularly successful, and I think they sold 700 copies of it, but what happened was that it ended up being played after the army had conquered Yugoslavia. It was played from Radio Belgrade and it went to Africa, and the people just immediately, the next day, everybody wanted to hear it. And it was everybody on all sides, so that they had to play it, and it became very popular. And it became popular among the British and among the French and among everybody. And so they all had their own...
Yeah, even though it was in German, it wasn't in English at that time.
At that time, yes. Yeah. The story is that that the men, the French and the English, just kept singing. The soldiers just kept singing it in German because that's the only version they had, and they kept tuning into Radio Belgrade rather than the BBC because they were playing that song that they liked. So finally, rather than forbidding the song, they decided they better make their own versions. And the British version was written, the words were written by this man named Tommy Connor, whose other great hit was I Saw Mommy Kissing Santa Claus.
Oh, wow. That's a Jewish song, I thought.
I don't know. It sounds Jewish, doesn't it?
Yeah, I thought I read that it was.
Well, it could be. Tommy Connor could be Jewish. I didn't look that up. I really ought to. Mm-hmm. But so all the different languages had their own versions, which were not exact translations at all. Yeah. And they all, I just think it's interesting that they all show their own particular, you know, national natures and the ways they translate it. For instance, the Italian talks about a rose that... that they want the soldier wants Lily to give him a rose wrapped in her blonde hair.
Well, that's just totally different, isn't it? That's just made up.
That's right. Exactly. and the Spanish one, which was sung by the Legion Azul, the Spanish SS, talks about going back and throwing flowers up on her balcony. So she ends up not under the lantern at all, but up on the balcony because it's Spain. That's what they do. And so it's interesting to actually listen to those, but we're not going to do that tonight. But it's easy to find them online. You can hear all different kinds of versions. But the interesting thing with the English one, it's very sentimental, very trite, very sentimental, but it's actually pretty good when Vera Lee, what was her name, sang it. They're a big singer. You know, it sounds good, but it's just not as good. You know, it's not as good the way the words go with the music or the words themselves.
You know, I copied here two versions of the English lyrics.
Oh, good.
But they don't sound as good as you said that the German is just better.
It's much better
than the translated English. And these two versions that I have here, I'm not going to read them because it probably take too long, but I could read just the first part because they're totally different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just how people translate. Like this one says, starts out, listen to the bugle, hear its silvery call, carried by the night air, telling one and all, now is the time to meet your girl, to meet your girl, to meet your girl, as once I met Marlene, my sweet Lily Marlene.
Well,
now, the other one, what?
I hadn't even heard that one, but go
ahead. Okay. Well, the other one I have says, right next to the barracks by the main gate, there stood a lantern and stands there up to date. We're going to meet there again. Next to the lantern, we will remain. Like then, Lily Marlene, like then, Lily Marlene.
Okay, that's an attempt at a literal translation. I doubt that one was sung. Here's one that was sung. This is the one that was the big hit in Britain.
Okay.
Underneath the lantern by the barrack gate, darling, I remember the way you used to wait. 'Twas there that you whispered tenderly that you loved me, you'd always be my lily of the lamplight. And then later on it goes, there beneath that far-off lantern light, I'd hold you tight, we'd kiss goodnight. Darling, I'd caress you and press you to my heart. So it's very overt, very sensual, very sentimental, pretty trite. There's one that Marlene Dietrich used to sing, which is like the American English version, which is even more trite sounding. We will create a world for two. I'll wait for you the whole night through. just very inferior poetry. So I'm going to give sort of a literal translation of the German now, so that
maybe
you can get an
idea. Because, you know, one thing that you see in the German, it's that first verse and the end, first verse and later on, too, ends with "Wie einst, Lily Marleen," "Wie einst," which is a once more, Lily Marleen, or once again.
Like as before. It's like
yes, that's right. That's right. Like
as
before.
Once was. Yeah, as it once was. But
some of these just ignore that altogether. Anyway.
Yeah, but you know, that's not
Debbie,
even.
Debbie, why don't you read it? Why don't you read it, the lyrics in German, before you, what were you going to do?
Okay, I can read each verse in German and then tell you what it means in English, literally, if you want.
Yeah.
Okay. So the first verse, vor der Kaserne, vor dem großen Tor, stand eine Laterne, und steht sie noch davor, so wollen wir uns da wiedersehen. Bei der Laterne wollen wir stehen, wie einst Lili Marleen. That means, in front of the barracks, by the main gate, stood a street light, and if it's still standing, we want to meet again there. By the streetlight, we want to stand as before, Lily Marleen. So it doesn't have...
Oh, that sent chills through me right then.
Really?
Yeah, it did.
And you know why? Because it doesn't say too much. It's mysterious.
It's also like he's remembering. He'd like to remember that time and bring that time back. You know, but it's not going to be anything but memory.
Yeah, well, so far it's not, but
actually
that's another difference in this between this and the others. But I'll just say generally before I continue, you know, this has much more, it's much more evocative, it's much less sentimental, it has real facts and real places and real images that get to you emotionally rather than just being so explicit that you're like, well, I don't need all of this. Okay, so here's the second verse. Unsere beiden Schatten sahen wie einer aus. Dass wir so lieb uns hatten, das sah man gleich daraus. Und alle Leute sollen es sehen, wenn wir bei der Laterne stehen, wie einst Lili Marleen. And that means, our two shadows looked like one. You could see right away how much we loved each other. And everyone will see it when we stand by the streetlight, as before Lili Marleen.
Yeah, and then that last is always repeated as wie einst Lily.
Yeah. Okay, and the next one, I love this verse. It says, schon rief der Posten, sie blasen Zapfenstreich. Es kann drei Tage kosten. Kamerad, ich komme gleich. Da sagten wir auf Wiedersehen. Wie gerne wollte ich mit dir gehen. Mit dir, Lily Marleen. Says, already the sentry called out, they're playing taps. That can cost you 3 days in the guardhouse. Comrade, I'm coming right away. There we said goodbye. How much I wanted to go with you. With you, Lily Marleen. So it changes from as before, Lily Marleen, saying, with you, Lily Marleen. And deine Schritte kennt sie. And Z is not she, it's it, the lamppost. Deine Schritte kennt sie, deinen schönen Gang. Alle Abend brennt sie, doch mich vergaß sie lang. Und sollte mir ein Leid geschehen, wer wird bei der Laterne stehen, mit dir, Lili Marleen? It, the streetlight, knows your step, your beautiful movements. Every night it burns, but it forgot me long ago. And if something happens to me, who will stand by the street light with you, Lily Marleen?
Oh, gosh.
Isn't that nice? It's not sentimental, but it's so imaginative because he's talking about what the street light knew. The way this keeps its distance, and at the same time it gives you these pictures.
Oh, yeah, I'm all overcome here. I really am.
You feel so much more than with these love, dove, kiss, squeeze lyrics, you know.
Right.
Okay. And this final verse is wonderful also. It says, aus dem stillen Raume, aus der Erde Grund, hebt mich wie im Traume, dein verliebter Mund. Wenn sich die späten Nebel drehen, werd ich bei der Laterne stehen, wie einst Lili Marleen. And that, I used to think that that meant out of the still, out of the silent room, out of the earth, the out of the earth. But it really, I guess, is more metaphorical. It means out of my quiet existence, out of the daily routine, your beloved lips rise up as in a dream. When the night mists are drifting, I will stand by the street light as before Lili Marleen.
Oh,
it's beautiful. It's evocative.
Yeah, that, but I mean, it's so it's so loving toward Lili Marleen.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's so beautiful. It's such a tribute, in a sense. None of those words are quite right, but...
Yeah, and it leaves so much to your imagination. I think that's one thing that made it just so, nobody knows what went on under the lamppost between those people. All you know is they were there. Well,
they were there because they wanted to be together there.
Yeah.
And that's for sure. And it was wartime, and he had to always go away. Mm-hmm. So that's what's so touching and sad about it. And so the German soldiers who were listening to this sure got a lot more out of it than the Allied soldiers did, didn't they?
That's right. But, a lot of this has wonderful sound, even just the Germans. The German words in the music, I think, sound very nice. But, yeah, it's so beautiful, this line, wenn sich die späten Nebel drehen. That's a really poetic line. When the late mists drift. Wenn sich die späten Nebel drehen, with these three closed consonants. It's just really beautiful, beautiful lyrics. And here I want to point out something very important about the German thing. I mean, there are so many things that are German about this poem that you don't see in the other translations. It's evocative rather than just in your face. Two, it's very action-oriented. And three, here's the thing at the end. He says, wenn sich die späten Nebel drehen, werd ich bei der Laterne stehen. I will stand by the streetlight as before. None of the others say that. They all say, oh, I'm dreaming about you. Oh, I'm remembering you. Oh, it seems as if you're near me. But none of the other versions say, I will be there with you, Lili Marleen. And I think that's a really great German positive action-oriented ending,
Well, I'm a real romantic, and this just, sends me off. I'm really glad we're doing this, because I'm real happy to learn about this. And, of course, German, the German words and trying to get their meaning, most things are translated, so they're just it's not good with poetry. I think it's very hard to translate poetry
from one
language to another. Yeah.
Maybe we could play the different version. This is what's interesting, is that Lala Anderson actually recorded a version by a different German composer who apparently was a student of Hindemith named Rudolf Zink. And we have a recording of that, and it's very interesting. Now that hopefully the listeners have a sense of the words, you could hear this other version and see what she does with them. I think she sings it wonderfully. Again, it's Lala Anderson, and this was recorded, I think, 1937.
Okay, and it's 3 minutes and 5 seconds long, and I like this one. I like the first one, but when I heard this one, I thought, wow, I mean, it's totally different. So let's listen to it. Wie einst Lili Marleen. Unsere
bei der Laterne stehen, wie einst, wie einst Lili Marleen. Schon rief der Posten, die Blasen Zapfenstreich, es kann drei Tage kosten. Kamerad, ich komm so gleich. Da sagten wir auf Wiedersehen, wie gerne wollt ich mit dir gehen, mit dir, Lili Marleen. Deine Schritte kennt sie, deinen zieren Gang, alle Abend brennt sie, mich vergaß sie lang. Und sollte mir ein Leid geschehen, er wird bei der Laterne stehen, mit dir, mit dir, Lili Marleen. Aus dem stillen Raume, aus der Erde Grund, hebt mich wie im Traume dein verliebter Mund. Wenn sich die späte Nebel drehen, werd ich bei der Laterne stehen, wie einst, wie einst.
Well, that was beautiful. Are you there, Margaret?
Yes, I had my mute on, so I wouldn't make noise.
Okay. That was okay. So beautiful.
Yeah, it sure was. Wow. She's a wonderful singer. I'd like to hear more of her things. I think maybe I want to say just a little bit more about this quotation by John Steinbeck about this song. He was a journalist.
He was a real liberal. Was he a communist or what was
he? Yeah, he was a real liberal, and he wrote this article about Lili Marleen, which manages to almost every single sentence in it be a lie or just mm-hmm. not bother to research it, you know. He misspells everybody's names and et cetera, and said that Lala Anderson was a Swedish girl. Anyway, but here's the thing. Finally, it was taken up by a singer, Lala Anderson, a Swedish girl who used it for her signature song. Lala Anderson has a husky voice and is what you might call the Hildegard type. I guess the lounge singer Hildegard. But anyway, here's the thing that I think was somewhat prevalent with the attitude towards Lili Marleen, which was that she was not a nice girl among the Americans, I think, especially had that impression often. Here's the paragraph.
Yeah, because she was standing under a street light.
That's
you know
right,
what
yeah.
we associate with women who girls who stand under street lights.
That's right.
But that wasn't it was just a wrong way to look at it altogether.
Yeah, they met there because it was right outside the barracks.
Yeah.
Okay, so this says, Lili Marleen is a very simple song. The first verse of it goes, underneath the lanterns by the barrack square, I used to meet Marlena and she was young and fair. The song was as simple as that. It went on to tell about Marleen, who first liked stripes and then shoulder bars. Marleen met more and more people until finally she met a brigadier, which was what she wanted all along. We have a song with much the same amused cynicism. Huh? That's not what the song was about. How'd he get that?
Oh, that's hideous. My gosh, that's horrible. What a monster.
Yeah, that's the way. I just have no idea if he really thought it was that or he didn't bother to listen to the...
Well, I think he was probably very anti-German.
Yeah, well,
and so he didn't want anything good to come from Germany.
Yeah,
you know.
It's amazing how many people just prostituted themselves, but I mean, I guess they believed it too. I mean, Dr. Seuss was a horrible anti-Nazi propagandist.
Yeah.
Did you know that? Yeah.
Oh, I did find out that, in later years, but I remember reading his books when I was young.
Yeah,
to
yeah,
you, you know.
That's right. But anyway, so.
But then you see, if you are one of those people, then the powers that be really play you up. So Dr. Seuss just made it big, big, big. And
yeah, yeah.
If he was not the way he was, if he was maybe even pro-German, you had never heard, seen
That's
Dr.
right.
Seuss.
His career would have been over, probably.
Yeah. So they make and break people. It's not really that something is better than something else all the time.
Exactly. Except this is an exception, of course, in a way, because this is something that got through simply by merit, because everybody loved it and it went out
right.
and they couldn't stop it, which is nice.
Well, what about the story about Joseph Goebbels? He didn't like the song
in
1939, and I don't know if this is true or not, but this is what they say everywhere. And he said he didn't want it. He put a stop to it. And then when it got so popular in North Africa and in that radio Belgrade, and the story I read was that there was a bombing or something, and all the records there had been smashed, and then somebody found a few, and you know, that had survived, and at the bottom of this one little box was this Lily Marlene. So, and they had to keep playing it because they didn't have any more. And then after that, Goebbels was overruled, and because the soldiers liked it so much and were demanding it. And then it was actually ordered that this be played every night at a certain time.
Yeah, well, I read that Rommel actually requested it. I think that that story is a little bit of an exaggeration about the bombing and that's the only one left, et cetera. I think I read somewhere else that, you know, he had a few records there and then he sent for some more from somewhere. And this was among the ones he sent for. And then I think it was only played once that night, maybe. Maybe it was played more than once. But the thing is that I think Rommel actually really liked it and saw that everybody else liked it. I guess it was said that the man who played it had a friend in the Africa Corps who really liked it, even though only 700 copies had been sold before. But he knew had a friend who liked it, so he played it. And then the demand was so great that it was asked for it to always be played. You know, every night it was the last thing played at a quarter.
Yeah, and they would wait to listen to it before they'd go to sleep. And this, I'm talking about the Americans and the English.
Everybody, yeah.
Is it right to say that this is the most popular World War II song of
all
of nations?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I've read it enough places, so I'm pretty sure it's true. And as I said, it's not an accident. You know, I think that not just the words are wonderful, but the melody and the rhythm, you know, it's a whole different kind. It is a march, so it can't be like that other version of it. But it just, there are so many things about it that just the way it goes from one part to another, it's very satisfying.
Well, we have this version by Willie Fritsch.
Before you play that, I want to just say that not only did Steinbeck say this about it, but I found, and I don't know where it is, so I can't read it to you, but even a really much more scurrilous song set to this tune, sung by American soldiers in Berlin, talking about how great it was there. You could get so much chocolate and this and that, and the girls are so cheap. And it ends up, the chorus is, "Wie viel, Lily Marlene? Wie viel, Lily Marlene?" That's how much, Lily Marlene. Oh, yeah, they're saying 10 marks for a girl or something. And then they say, "Wie viel, Lily Marlene? Wie viel, Lily Marlene?" So that's the, okay, we can.
Nasty.
Yeah. Well, let me say just something about this Willy Fritsch version. It's nice to hear it sung by a man, since it's actually a man's song, though you can see it would have gotten more popular with a woman singing it, since the soldiers were men. But Willy Fritsch was a very popular movie actor of the Third Reich, and you can notice some different things here. One of the things is that line where she goes, "Und da 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 da," und. Anyway, he sings the words. He puts the word right on the beat where Lala Anderson had done it differently. You might notice that. But he also does his R's in a very kind of classical way. He, instead of going "ruh," he goes "ruh," like a little Italian at R. It's a very nice version, I think, and it's nice to hear a different one. So, okay, that's all I was going to say.
All right, well, let's see. I was looking at my email, but I don't see anything here. Okay, so I guess everybody can hear me, and there's no problems with the with the sound. All right, let's go and play Willie Fritsch.
Vor der Kaserne, vor dem großen Tor, stand seine Laterne und steht sie noch davor. So wollen wir uns da wiedersehen, bei der Laterne wollen wir stehen, wie ein Lili Marleen, wie ein Lili Marleen. Unsere beiden Schatten sahen wie einer aus, dass wir so lieb uns hatten, das sah man gleich heraus. Und alle Leute sollen es sehen, wenn wir bei der Laterne stehen, wie ein Lili Marleen, wie ein Lili Marleen. Schon rief der Posten, die Blasenzapfen streich, das kann drei Tage kosten, am Rathen komm sogleich. Da sagten wir auf Wiedersehen, wie gerne wollt ich mit dir gehen, mit dir, Lili Marleen, mit dir, Lili Marleen. Deine Schritte kennt sie, deine vielen Gang, alle Abend kennt sie doch nicht vergaß sie lang. Und sollte mir ein Leid geschehen, wer wird bei der Laterne stehen? Mit dir, Lili Marleen, mit dir, Lili Marleen. Aus dem stillen Raume, auf der Erde Grund, hebt mich wie im Traume dein verliebter Mund. Wenn sich die späten Nebel drehen, werd ich bei der Laterne stehen, wie einst Lili Marleen.
Now that was an interesting one, and I have a question. If you get your mic, if your mic is turned back on now,
yes,
Margaret, that is. He has this sound in his voice. I like listening to him because there's this kind of trembling or something.
Yeah, vibrato. Yeah.
Yeah. Is that something he does, or is that in the recording equipment?
I think it's a combination. I think it sounds as if he's kind of classically trained. So you'll tend to have a little vibrato because just your voice is like flowing very freely from all the exercise. But I think that those kind of recordings from them have a little bit more of that slightly tinny sound, which maybe brings it out a little more.
Yeah, I've always thought that was kind of the recording, but you hear it in men more than you do in women.
Mm-hmm. Well, they've, so you know, yeah. Well,
what? Go ahead.
I just said you would hear it if you heard a woman opera singer of that time, and you might hear that little bit of a excess, you're like,
I like it. And then he pronounces, it's easier to follow the words as I'm looking at the German words here while they're singing. It's easier to follow the words. He pronounces them more clearly, it seems to me. Plus, I like the way he slowed down on the last verse.
Yeah,
I really like that.
Yeah, I noticed later that actually Lala Anderson did that a little bit, but not as much. And, you know, he really, that line, wenn sich die späten Nebel drehen, he really, really sang that well. Did you notice that? You really heard those words and how beautiful they were.
Yeah.
I want to just say also, just with regard to this, something I mentioned to you, that people don't know enough about the music in the Third Reich, and I certainly don't, because people just don't study it because it's taboo. Maybe they're studying it more in Germany now. I don't know. I'd like to find out. When I was going to a Catholic university studying voice performance, I asked somebody who'd been there for 4 years, have you ever studied music in the Third Reich? And she said, oh, yeah, they kicked out all the Jews.
That's what they learned.
Yeah, that's what they didn't do. That's what didn't happen in Third Reich Germany music. And actually, you know, it was a golden age. And that's something that really needs to be, a lot of work needs to be done to really get that out there, because, I mean, there were wonderful things going on there. And this is just an example of just a little popular song, how wonderful it is.
Mm-hmm. We'll have to do a show on that. I'd love to do that.
Yeah, I'd love to research
play
it.
Play some of it. And, I'll have you you research it all and prepare something.
Okay, I'll do
and
that.
And we'll do it. I love it. And I bet the listeners have really enjoyed this. We're going to have to move on now. We've got in our last half hour, and I'm trying to decide I think I better stick with the women theme, and if there's time, I'll do this other thing at the end that I wanted to bring up. But I thought we would tie in here a little bit with our nationalists. So, in fact, I titled this show Women in Nationalism. You know, I had the hardest time putting this together and thinking what it could be called or how to tie it all together, because it's just so many different things. But I wanted to mention women who have done outstanding things. Let's see, who have not had families. And there I'm coming back to the white nationalist thing and the, you know, the idea of what's expected of people and so on, and all the criticism that's put out. You said you don't experience it. That's put out for women who have not had children and are doing whatever they want to do, supposedly, and having careers, or not, it's not really a career, but doing other things, and this is like some kind of failing. Now, not all men talk like this or think like this, but it's an undercurrent, and a lot of them come right out with it, and I've been called every kind of thing. Because I, by certain horrible people, not everybody, I don't want to blanket the good men out there who really have stood up for me and don't say anything bad about me and always listen to my shows and so on. But, you know, this is something I think is so damaging, because we're always talking, we had a couple of articles, but don't really have time to go into them too much. But about this idea of why there's no women in nationalism, period, but white nationalism is even worse, you know. Because they're not treated well by so many people, and you know, those who talk badly about women ought to be talked to by the more intelligent men or the better men who don't go along with that. And sometimes they are, and sometimes they're not, because it's hard for men to get after men, other men. That's what I think, especially in defense of women. Once in a while they can do it. But a lot of these men think that all women have to be raising families. Well, it would be nice if that could be the case, but they say, therefore, we shouldn't be educating women. A lot of them really do believe this, and if they got in power, which I guess they wouldn't, so you maybe don't have to worry about it. This is exactly what they do. They stop women's education at age 15 or something, I guess, and then put them out there in the marriage market and hope that they had a bunch of kids while they were still young, and that's, you know, what they want to do with them. And high IQ women, of course, are the ones less likely to want to do that, and they want to further their education and do things, and yet these are the ones that we would like to have reproducing high IQ men and women, and healthy and, you know, strong. Usually, often that goes together, not always, but here you have, I've come up with solutions to this in the past, But then people find some kind of fault with it, usually men. So, but now I wanted to mention some women who everybody admires and thinks highly of and wouldn't criticize like they would criticize, say, me. And I don't know, you said you haven't run into that, but you're not on the internet.
That's right. As you said,
I'm
pretty low profile and not on the internet much.
Yeah, right. So, but I just want to bring up a lot of these. Some of these are Germans because they're the ones I know about. But Hannah Reich, the German National Socialist, who was a great pilot, and she was a great patriot, and she was born in 1912, didn't die until 1979. She never married, never had a child. She wasn't a lesbian. She worked with men all the time, and she worked hard to be able to have them respect her for what she could do. She didn't get any free passes. And I wrote an article about her, which you can find at carolynyeager.net. I've just moved it into newer articles. It's at the bottom there now. But it's called Hannah Reich, Warrior of Flight and Freedom. And it's a pretty good article. I think I covered everything quite well. But she did, I think, have a love affair or two, but she was totally into wanting to be a pilot and into flying from the time she was a little girl, you know. And she had this incredible ability to concentrate. And through that, and she practiced it too. She didn't just have it, you know, for free. I mean, she also practiced it a lot. She had tremendous strong will and discipline. And so through that, she overcame everything that she needed to overcome to become a very, very good pilot. And her story is fascinating and wonderful. And she remained a loyal National Socialist too. She never caved in like they wanted her to. They worked on her, but she never would. And she would never leave Germany either after the war. Now, then there's Leni Riefenstahl, who everybody knows, doesn't need an introduction. She lived until to be 101. She was born in 1902 and didn't die until 2003. Most people know her story. You know, she started out in dance and then moved into film acting and then into film directing. And, of course, her most famous film is Triumph of the Will, if anybody needs to know that, and then Olympia and was another one, a few. I've got some information about her here, I want to read something here, that she said. You're going to find this interesting, Margaret.
Okay.
Describing her experience in her memoir, which I didn't read her memoir, she wrote, "I had an almost apocalyptic vision that I was never able to forget." This is when she met Hitler. She said it seemed she heard him speak here. I'm sorry. She heard him speak at a rally in 1932. And she said she was just mesmerized. And this is how she described it. And a lot of women have written like this. I probably would too.
Oh, yeah.
She said, "I had an almost apocalyptic vision that I was never able to forget. It seemed as if the Earth's surface were spreading out in front of me like a hemisphere that suddenly splits apart in the middle, spewing out an enormous jet of water, so powerful that it touched the sky and shook the Earth."
Wow, that's pretty cool.
And she was kind of a mystical-minded person, you know, from her films, you know that. And she she said she read Mein Kampf while she was making her film The Blue Light. And she says that the book made a tremendous impression on me. "I became a confirmed National Socialist after reading the first page. I felt a man who could write such a book would undoubtedly lead Germany. I felt very happy that such a man had come." I wonder how many people know that about her. Well, then she made the film Victory of Faith of the fifth Nazi Party rally. And Hitler liked that, and he invited her to, then she did the other one. Then he invited her to film the Olympic Games in Berlin in 1936. But she says also here, In 1937, she told the Detroit News, "To me, Hitler is the greatest man who ever lived. He truly is without fault, so simple and at the same time possessed of masculine strength." Well, this shows you, and with Hannah Reich, too, also loved Adolf Hitler, and mm-hmm. and Sylvia Stoltz, too, who I'm going to mention next. And they, it shows that they love men, you know, that
uh-huh.
these are strong,
yeah, that's right.
strong women who cannot be, really be contained in the little, you know, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with being a homemaker, but they just have too much going for them, too much they need to do and want to do. But they love men, and they have, but she never had any children in all her long life. And you'd think these women would be the best candidates, you know, because of all their gifts, the quality of the character, of their character and so on. But
how about Savitri Devi? Did she have any children?
Well, you know what? I don't know. I don't think so.
I don't think she did.
I don't think so.
So she's the absolute idol of white nationalists. So they better not trash you for that. They're not going to trash her.
Yeah, well, they'll say, well, you didn't do what they did. But, you know, still, it's all the same. They don't understand that not every woman is going to do that. Even if they would like to do it. Things happen. There's just... Things happen in people's lives and so on. Anyway, Sylvia Stoltz, you know, she was born in 1963. She's probably around your age or something, or maybe she's a little younger. A little younger than you. She married a Horst Mahler. And,
no, she did not.
Well, they say she's married to him.
I know. I've read that on...
Oh, I thought that. I thought they hadn't married, but then sometimes it says...
Yeah, I read that on some sites, too. So when I was doing the interview of her, I asked her, and she said, no, that's over. And I'm sure they were never married.
Oh, okay. So, but anyway, she's had no children. He's had no children. She doesn't seem like she wants to find somebody to have children with. So you met her in Germany.
Yes.
And if you can tell us without, you know, sorry, it's going to have to be kind of brief, but
okay.
You know, what she's like and what your experience was.
Oh, well, I wasn't prepared for this. I should have been. But anyway, I'll remember. I met her. It was interesting. I met her at the trial of a man who was on trial for having a Reich ID with a swastika on it. So they had him for displaying a swastika. Now, he didn't want to display the swastika. They asked for his ID at the bank, so he pulled it out. And it's legal to carry that form of identification in Germany because the Reich is still legal, though they don't like to admit it.
They don't admit it, but they know it's true, huh?
Yeah. And so he pulled out his ID at the bank, and the man disappeared from the counter and went back and whispered with some other people, and next thing you know, he had to go to court. And so I witnessed this trial. Well, this is a little off subject, but, I mean, the judge was just, you know, it just shows, I mean, people are horrible. They sentenced him, of course, even though it was totally legal what he did. There was nothing he did wrong, but he was sentenced to pay some big fine, and... Then he tried to say a few words as is his right after the sentencing, and the judge just turned around and walked out. It was really
sickening.
Yeah, but anyway, so I met her. People got together after that in a restaurant, and I'd already talked to the editor at the Barnes Review about doing an interview with her while I was over there. So then I asked her a few questions then, which didn't go very well because my German was pretty lame at that point. But so we finished the interview on the phone, and she's very uncompromising. I mean, she's like, no, we want our land back, we want the Reich back, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which is good, mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm. And of course, I totally admire what she did. You know, I guess not everybody knows, she was the defense lawyer for Ernst Zundel, and she was then taken to court for having defended him, because that's what happens in Germany, because by defending him, she was, you know, saying things that she shouldn't say. So then she went to jail for 3 years and had her law license taken away.
Yeah, well, she's a great heroine. Everybody thinks she's a heroine. I don't care. Everybody thinks she is. Everybody loves her. Everybody admires her. But because of her bravery, you know, and I'm glad to hear. I could tell. I mean, I know she is, but I'm glad to hear you say that, that she's so, that she is one of those uncompromising ones.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, okay, so then there's a couple more. There's Amelia Earhart I came upon. She's another famous pilot. She was a German-American. And she was, I don't know, she was considered to be kind of a liberal-thinking woman. And she was engaged to someone, and then she broke it off. And then later she became friendly with another man, and it took, she wasn't sure, but she finally married him, and then they were divorced shortly after, it seems like. She divorced the other guy. No, she never married the other guy. Anyway, I'm just trying to go through.
Yeah, I think I remember, unless I'm mixing her up with somebody else, that she had an agreement with her husband. If one of us falls in love with somebody else or whatever, that's it. You know, that we do whatever we want. And
yeah, yeah, that's the way the marriage was for her. You know,
yeah.
It was, she called it a partnership with dual control. They didn't have children. And of course, she was killed early in that plane where her, she was lost, you know, in the, she'd
lost,
never been found.
Presumed killed. She's certainly dead by now.
Yeah. So there's, you know, everybody admires Amelia Earhart. You know, she's so famous and everything. I don't think people would fault her for not having children. And the last one I came up with, there's a lot more, but I came up with Eva Perón, a white Argentinian who I've always kind of admired her. I like her. She had a very vital spirit. People criticize her for very different reasons, but boy, she had a lot of life in her. And will and so on, and strength and power, and she didn't have any children. They didn't have any children. So,
well, one thing I just want to say concerning white nationalists faulting you or anyone for that is that I believe Hitler's attitude was very different. For one thing, I think there were more men than women. I mean, more women than men in Germany. So he didn't think every woman was going to get married.
Yeah, whether it was that or not, I didn't think about that, but I know that he didn't think that every woman would get married, and he didn't think that every man, because he knew that not everybody got married. It's just always been that way.
And he
didn't get married.
Yeah, that's right. But he supported career women. You know, people think that, oh, he just wanted to trample on women. They had to be, you know, in the kitchen and having babies. No, not everyone. No, he did not.
He wanted to help married women, and particularly young married women, to learn about how to do well at what they were doing, and that makes it more enjoyable, so they weren't just lost there, you know, trying to cope. And he always had, in National Socialists, always had these service workers, these young women and men, young women in this case, going and helping these women with larger families.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the main things that they did in their national service,
mm-hmm.
That they did and so on. So he was very, very, always very helpful to women, and he appreciated women so very much. And now I want to just mention here this thing I came across today, which just horrifies me. It's called the Scholes Bridle. It was I've got a picture here of it, of this harness thing on this woman's face. Shutting up her mouth.
Oh my God.
It's made of, like, looks like it's leather, or I suppose it's leather and not metal or something, because that would be too. But not only is the strap going across her mouth, and then the strap goes up on either side of her nose and then joins together and up her forehead and is attached to this big thing over her head. But there's this picture of these little attachments, which I guess are what go in the mouth. Because it says that this thing, there's a little mark here, a little square here where the mouth is, and there's something that goes inside the mouth so
like
that she can't talk.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
And one of them, the one in the middle has little sharp points on it, and the other two are flat but different shapes. And so something that would, you know, keep, because if with the, without that, I guess she could still try to talk, but she can't talk now. And this is, here's what it says, the Scholes Bridle, a British invention, possibly originating in Scotland, I wouldn't be surprised, used between the 16th and 19th century. It was a device, and here's how they present it, like just like some of these men today would be want to talk about a woman. It was a device used to control, humiliate, and punish gossiping, troublesome women by effectively gagging them. The scold comes from a common, from the common scold, which means a public nuisance. More often than not, women who habitually gossiped and quarreled with their neighbors, while the name bridle describes the part that fitted into the mouth. Well, you know, how much do women go out and cause trouble?
I don't know.
I mean, I just think that's overdone, but husbands could do this if they wanted to punish their wife. It's kind of awful. Truly.
Yeah, I think it's pretty awful.
And this is things like this, when women see stuff like this, then they say, man, I wouldn't want to go back to those days for anything in the world.
Yeah, right? I wouldn't want one of those in my mouth.
I wonder how long they'd keep it there. It would just be horrible, and it's so humiliating, too, like we said. Well, we've got just a few minutes. Is there anything you wanted to say?
Well, somebody mentioned to me that I left out Marlene Dietrich when we were talking about Lily Marlene.
I leave her out on purpose. I didn't want to talk about her.
Yeah, I think I mentioned her name when I said that this was the most atrocious translation, the really most trite one. And
she became so famous. Yes, she was promoted by the enemies of Germany, and
she was a traitor.
She was just a traitor. So
she was a traitor. Yep.
I mean,
she wasn't that good a singer either. You know,
no,
she
was
worse.
So beautiful. She just had this fantastic looks.
She
had quite a style in the movies and all. I mean, if the Germans tried to get her back, Goebbels tried real hard, and Hitler wanted him to get her back because she was so famous.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought it'd be so good for Germany.
Yeah.
But she kind of played with the idea at some point, but then she didn't really ever come through. So
I saw a later performance of hers, maybe it was 1960 or something, and she kind of looked like a hag by then, but it was ridiculous. She says, I sang this in such and such and such and such in Mannheim and in Ireland and in here and no, Northern Ireland, I guess it was, and then she sings it, and she's not even singing, she says, just like,
well, that's what happens when you get so famous that you think you can't quit. You know, you have to keep going.
Yeah.
Have a bad end. You come to a bad end then.
Yeah, she deserved it.
Well, I don't think I'm going to bring this other thing up in this show tonight because I just don't think it fits. I can bring it up on, I guess I'll have to wait till... I told him, you know, since I guess I will... Margaret, we can go 15 minutes over, but the people listening live don't hear it, but it is on the recording. So mm-hmm. I'm going to, if you don't mind, what I'm going to do is play the outro when the time comes. And then I won't turn the show off. That's why it's good that they have this. You have to turn the show off. You have to end it manually because if you want to go on for that extra 15 minutes, you can.
Oh, that's nice.
Is that fine with you?
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay, then we can go back to some of these things about women. But I'm going to start now. I don't know if I'll finish, but because you, the first time you came on the Heretics Hour, it was because you had written me something about, because I'd been talking about it, but you wrote me something about this, Kevin Strom thing with Rodney Martin and how Rodney Martin was attacking Kevin Strom on this Facebook page. And you thought it was so wrong, and you copied the page, and then we talked about that on the program, right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I thought his behavior was very peculiar.
Right, and so now here's some more peculiar behavior from Rodney Martin, and it involves Frederick Tobin. About 2 months ago, at least, if it wasn't longer, I had been reading Rodney Martin's ANNA website and went to the board of directors page, and there was write-ups there of Rodney and one of the other two board members. And I could tell that each person wrote their own. And I could tell that this was Rodney who wrote his. It sounded like him. Now, I could be wrong, but that was my impression. And I saw that he had written a bunch of praise for himself from what he called the movement heavyweights. And among those was Frederick Tobin. And he said that Frederick told him he had a Wagnerian life and, his German family values and so on. So I just mentioned that to Frederick Tobin. He wanted to know what he said, so I sent him the quote from it. And he didn't like it. And so he wrote to Rodney and told me that he was going to write to Rodney and ask him to remove that. Because he didn't want to be associated with Mark Weber and, other things. He didn't think that he said that about the Wagnerian life and so on. And he didn't hear back from Rodney. And over the course of 2 months, at least, he's been writing. He's been emailing Rodney again and again. Not like every day or every week, but, every so often. More lately. And he's told me, and he said, check and see if it's still there. And I say, no, it's not there anymore. I say, yeah, it's still there. And we were just discussing, how wild it is for Rodney to just ignore that.
Yeah.
And finally, he tried to get somebody else in on it. And then yesterday, he got an email from Rodney. And now let's see. We've still got 2 minutes left on the stream. Don't let me go past that. At 1 minute, I have to play the outro. And then, ladies and gentlemen, we'll stay on and we'll continue. So so he finally heard back from Rodney. And what does Rodney say? He sent it to me. He said it's okay for me to say this tonight. He doesn't mind because he's kind of disgusted. So Rodney writes to Frederick finally and says, hello, Fred. I have been very busy and traveling and just caught up with the emails. Can you believe that? he hasn't been traveling all this time. And he didn't just catch up with his emails. See, this is what I mean. Rodney is just a compulsive liar. He just, everything he says is a lie. It's just, he can't be straight about things. He tried to ignore it, hoped it would go away. He didn't want to change what was on there. But finally, he's, okay, 90 seconds. Our music is 56 seconds. So, ladies and gentlemen, I already said what I'm going to do, but I do want to close out here. I will continue this after the outro music. I want to close out the show and say thank you all for listening. And, of course, again, my guest was Margaret Huffstickler. So here's the outro music. All right, and we're still on,
mm-hmm.
and we'll continue here. So, so Rodney says, writes to Frederick, as after he says he just caught up with his emails, as I told you previously, I don't know if he told him that previously, I do not maintain the website, nor was I the author of the bio that seems to be causing you so much heartburn, which is kind of, you know, not very respectful. I did finally call and reach the author after having a hard time reaching him, and he assured me, one, that he did not write it as a reference from you, nor can anyone come away with that with it in that way, which I don't understand, really. And two, he is a long, this author of the bio, is a longtime listener to my and other shows and merely took statements, quotes, and excerpts, that is, what people said in the various shows in developing the bio. And Rodney underlined what people said in the various shows in developing the bio. Now, does this make sense?
No.
No. No. He's got somebody who he has a hard time getting in touch with for 2 months and finally gets in touch with him, who wrote, who's doing his website there. That's not true.
No.
You can tell it's Rodney Martin style. It's the kind of confused, like I was talking about European Nights website. I mean, his is worse. It's just stuff stuck all over the place. And he wrote that. He wrote his own bio. They all wrote their own stuff. I know how these things work. You don't have somebody doing that you don't even hardly ever talk to. It's just supposed to research it. I mean, it's so patently, like all the things he says, it's so patently false.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes on, I asked him, he means this person that he wrote the bio, I asked him to re-review that show, which he said he already did. He even cited the date and time of the show because he said he had saved each of the shows, which he had used quotes. He reminded me that this is no different if he himself privately posted this bio, which he said he may do and included the links to each radio. Then he's got a period, and then on the down, skipped a line, show, as his own blog post. So somehow he messed that up, but it's just supposed to be, he may do so and included the links to each radio show as his own blog post. His own blog post? This this person is going to privately post this bio of Rodney?
That's very peculiar.
Peculiar. Not what I'd call it. I'd call it a total fairy tale, and this is the kind of fairy tales that he's come up with from the start.
But what I think is peculiar is that he does it. You know, why? Why
well,
not
I know.
Say, oh, I'll take it off. Okay, you don't like it, I'll take it off.
Well, right, because he didn't take it all off. He took a few words off. So now he goes on and says to Frederick Tobin, I told him, this writer of the Bible.
This fictitious.
Yeah. Now listen to this. I told him you are getting on in years and seem to be under pressure based, it should be, on your relationship with a now discredited person. What do you mean,
oh, my
me? Who is causing issues. And I asked him to modify the bio and or insert the link to the show. He didn't ask him to take that stuff out. Well, he asked him to modify it. So Rodney says, as of today, he told me he worked with our webmaster. So this bio writer is not even the webmaster, but supposedly there is a webmaster.
Oh, he's got a huge retinue, I guess.
Yeah, right. That's how he likes to put it. So he's not responsible for any of this stuff. No matter what anybody might complain about, and has, one, removed your name in the list of heavyweights, and two, has not...
So there. Revenge.
And two, has only referenced your comments generally and in the context of having been on the show in November of 2013. In future, he goes on. Rodney can't stop, you know. For future reference, When you do interviews, don't say things you don't want quoted. We do not have a time machine that we can hop in and go back and undo an interview in the event people get pressure from freaks and old feminists, that's me again, who shared sheets, listen to this, who shared sheets with Jews and like to scream at people until they submit to their agenda. You know, he's still going on this thing that my former husband was a Jew, which he wasn't. And so he doesn't care what the facts. He's never provided any proof that my former husband was a Jew. He can't, but he keeps saying it anyway. And so do the rest of his
crowd. That's the way he was in that thing when I first sent you. You know, he just doesn't matter if something's been disproved. He's just got to keep saying it anyway, just to smear people.
Yeah, then he says that his the things that I've said about him have all been disproved, which they haven't, you know. But I try to only talk about the facts, like what I've got here is what he wrote. And so he finishes up, some people just love to fight the nutty battles of the nutty 90s. I have no time for Jews, feminists, dementia, and drama. Signed, Rodney Martin, ANA, ANN chairman.
yeah, chairman.
Yeah, so I mean,
self-created organizations.
and so if you go to his, all right, let me do it. If you go to his website, what's still there about poor Fred Tobin is that, whoops, I'm going where I don't need to go. What it still says is, oh God, the thing he's got on there, you have to turn it off. Drives you crazy. It goes on and on. You go to ANA Board of Directors, and you don't find Frederick's name among the heavyweights anymore, but you do find him, and he has modified this other statement, which he won't remove, see, because he just won't. He's so stubborn about these things. He says, sorry about that. I'm coming right up to it here. He says, after he talks about how the great things that that David Duke said about him, he says the very next day, on November 13th, 2013, Dr. Frederick Tobin, in an interview with Martin, made positive statements alluding to Martin's dedication to family and German traditions. So he removed the part about Rodney Martin having a Wagnerian life. So, you know, I mean, why didn't he take it out like he was asking?
Yeah, I guess he's desperate for these kudos.
Yeah, he is. I mean, there's something so wrong here. You called it peculiar, but, I mean, this is there's something so very wrong with these people.
It's like he's got this itch, you know. He's so spiteful, and he's just got to scratch this itch.
Yeah,
keeping on writing when he doesn't even have to. All he has to say is, sorry, I missed your email before, overlooked it before, I'll get that off right away. Period. Done. He doesn't have to waste any time, but no, he can't do that.
Right. Right. And also, he thinks that he can lie like he does. So obvious, and that people aren't going to know it. See? And that is like, I think that is like a little child. I mean, I remember when I was a little child, and I thought that if I denied something, and nobody saw me doing it, you know, nobody could blame it on me. And I could just say, no, not me. I didn't do that. And I didn't know because I was a little child that grown-ups and older people can see right through that because their brains are more developed. And you're not fooling anybody. And yet Rodney, to me, lies in the same way, like a little child, and thinks that people will believe him.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And so maybe he has a retarded development or what you call a suspended development.
Yeah, well, you know what just occurred to me? I was thinking about, does he have wide-set eyes? Sometimes that's a sign of ADD.
He does. Yeah, he does.
Yeah, so, because
well, people have said he's ADD because he can't write, he makes lots of mistakes, and he spells badly. He must be using spell check all the time because he still used to write things. I guess he didn't use all those aids like he does now. He would write essays, back when I was still, you know, communicating with him and so on, and Bill Fink, too, and he sent me this thing he wrote one time, and I was just horrified. I was just amazed. I didn't know what to say. I said, this needs to be edited. And he said, oh, I'm just editing. I'm editing it. And then he sent it to me again after it was edited. It was just as bad, practically. And I sent it to Bill Fink, and he said, oh, my God. He said, he can't write. And I said, no, we can't. But then people said, oh, that's mean to say that because he has dyslexia. But,
oh, he has dyslexia?
Hmm. Well, I don't think he has dyslexia because that's not the kind of problem he has. What did you say he was, ADD?
ADD, yeah, or ADHD, attention deficit disorder.
I'm not going to
I don't
try
know.
To, you know, diagnose anybody or say what their reasons are. All I know is that he's got some serious faults. And,
yeah, I just thought of that because of his eyes, but they're not that wide set. They're just peculiar. I won't say anymore.
They're shaped a little funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, I don't want to sit here and bash Rodney, but
yeah,
I mean,
that's enough of that.
Yeah, okay.
My part.
All right. Well, I appreciate you going along with this. And I don't even know how much time we have left and when we'll be cut off, actually. So I guess we could just close the show now when we feel like it because we're still recording.
Okay.
I think I got everything in.
Yeah.
Quite well. So if
we could talk. Oh, go ahead. Well, I was going to say we could talk about what we might want to do sometime in the future.
Yeah, we could talk about it with everybody listening. Well, I do want to do that thing you said. What was that? Oh, Third Reich music.
Yes, that would be great.
I just loved what we did here with Lily Marlene. I really love
that's
it.
That's great. I hope people like it. I will get some good feedback about that. It was really fun to do.
Yeah, and so I just need to get MP3s, that's all, of the music we're going to play.
Yeah, and I know there's a man who's a specialist in Germany on Third Reich music, and I should look him up, and that would be a really good project. That'd be great.
Yeah, okay, well, you get going on that, Margaret, and you'll have us, we'll do it here.
Okay.
I look forward to that. Well, I enjoyed tonight very much, and... you're always such a good sport, and I want to thank you. And I'm sorry, I apologize if I brought you into any of my gossipy or complaining things that you might not have wanted.
That's okay.
But,
you don't want to get one of those skulls.
That's right. They put that on me, I know.
If they could, they would.
Yeah, they would. That's a horrible thing. If you saw the picture, you'd be, oh, gosh. Well, all right, then. Thank you, Margaret, and thank you, listeners, and we'll see you. I'll see you on Thursday and see you here on the Heretics Hour next week. Good
Thanks
night.
Thanks for having me on, Carolyn. Good night.